Still, as I said, is going to be resolutions of Hilbert modules. I'm going to be talking about this is a subject very much in progress. White chalk. Okay. It's a subject very much in progress, and there isn't any. It would be premature to write a book about the subject, for example. So I'm going to be looking at examples. I'm going to be looking at examples with theorems of what one can talk about, and I'll remind you, in other words, I suspect everybody here knows I've been promoting the idea of looking at Hilbert modules, as the title said, and all this means for me is basically that we've got a Hilbert space, which I'll call H here. Everything is going to be complex, and we've got an I guess it was just turned on or something, or did I? Anyway. I see. So what happens is it depends on where the microphone is. It seems to be very sensitive to that. Anyway, so we've got a Hilbert space H, and we've got an algebra. And the algebra could be a variety of things. I'm only going to be talking about the case where the algebra is either the polynomials, the commutative polynomials, or something like A of, and I could take A of omega for omega contained in CM. But in fact, let's specialize and let's take it to either be the poly disk or the ball. And you can, as most of you know, also do this with a non-commutative algebra, and the one that's usually used would be the non-commutative polynomials. But I'm not going to talk about that case at all. Partly it's a matter of taste. Partly it's a matter that, at least at this point, the connections of this subject with other parts of, say, complex geometry or algebraic geometry or several complex variables is sufficiently great that I find it fascinating to try to develop this particular direction here. And examples, well, again, there are lots of examples, and in fact, there are examples that people have studied in this subject when you're doing sort of function theory or functional analysis and function theory, also harmonic analysis and so forth. But perhaps the most familiar example is either the Hardy space or the Hardy module, and we can do this. The most familiar one, of course, is when we do it over the disk, the standard one, but we can also, of course, do the Hardy space over the poly disk or the Hardy space over the ball. And, of course, we can also do the Bergman space or the Bergman module. When I use module, the point is that what one is usually interested in, although not always, not entirely, I mean, when you study Hilbert spaces of holomorphic functions, which these all are, one can be interested in only the structure of the functions that are in those spaces. But quite often, even if that's what your goal is, you're interested in the operators that act on those spaces, the multipliers, and a variety of other kinds of things. The Bergman module, you can do this, of course, for any omega contained in CM, and even more generally than that. But, and then I'm not going to use this notation very much. The analytic functions in omega, which are in the L2 space, where we're going to use volume measure here. And, of course, we can talk about weighted Bergman spaces. We could talk about the Dirichlet space. We could talk about a whole bunch of those spaces. But, again, I'm not going to worry too much about this. Now, one of the motivations for doing something like this has to do with the theory of Nash and Foyash having to do with contractions. I remind you, if I've got a operator on a Hilbert space so that it is a contraction operator, then in fact, of course, the von Neumann inequality tells me that I can define an action here where this is simply just phi of z acting on a vector is simply phi of t, f. And you can define that in various ways, one of which is simply to take the polynomials and define that in the obvious way, and then extend it by using the von Neumann inequality. And in this particular case here, then, what you end up with is a Hilbert module over the disk algebra, or you could talk about it as being over the polynomials in one variable, which is contractive, which is the same thing. And one of the questions, of course, that you can ask is the following. This is where resolutions come from. If I have general Hilbert modules, how to study? I think what's... Hello? Hello? I see. So, well... out of my pocket, maybe. Let me try it. Hello? 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 Do I need it? No. What do you want me to do? You want me to just continue? Huh? Is it working now? Oh. Okay, well, a little adversity. In any case, the question is how to study general modules. And when I'm talking about contractions, one, of course, has the theory of Nash and Tuohy. And let me talk about that in a very somewhat different way. In other words, I recall... that if I'm given a contraction operator, and if I make a mild assumption about it, if I assume that the powers of the adjoint go strongly to zero, then in fact, and so I've got T on H, then in fact there exist Hilbert spaces, E and E star, I'll call them, and an inner function, theta of z, going from e to e star. Inner function simply, this is now a bounded holomorphic function from bounded operators going from e to e star, such that if I look at the boundary values on the circle, this is an isometry almost everywhere in this particular situation. And so I can write down a sequence of the H2 space tensor E, the H2 space tensor E star, and theta is the map, the multiplication map here, and I have the map H here. And so I have a resolution. I have a very nice resolution because this map here is a co-isometry. This map is an isometry. And I have a resolution by basically Hardy modules where I'm where I'm allowing arbitrary multiplicity from this point of view. And the Nash-Tuohy theory basically doesn't look at it in this language right here. It basically studies H, or studies T on H, by studying this much right here, or by studying this, which is the same thing. So one of the things that I've been looking at is the question of if I go to more general situations, can I erase this now? Is everybody... written down the password and the, maybe I should know it too, but I guess it's it. Okay. So one kind of goal or one kind of question, which is of course exactly what one does in algebra, is given a general Hilbert module over an algebra Allison, we just call it A at this point, find nice, which I'm not going to define at this point, resolutions for H in terms of, and again, I'll simply just say nice, Hilbert modules. Now, of course, one, there's three parts to this. One is one has to decide what nice means in both these cases right here. And, of course, one then needs to know that such resolutions exist. And once you get resolutions, then the question is how do you study the module in terms of all this. So it's a big program here, but it's this usual program in algebra that, in fact, one of the consequences of that program was homological algebra, trying to figure out how do you extract information from resolutions. But this one here is closer to, complex geometry and algebraic geometry than it is to just plain algebra. Now, if I look at the examples we've got here, or if I look at the examples I've got here, as I said, these are Hilbert spaces of holomorphic functions. These, you can think of these as being functions that take values in E star, and so forth. And so that's kind of what the goal is going to be. Nice Hilbert modules are going to more or less correspond to Hilbert spaces of holomorphic functions, where I can put a quotes around this. Actually, the quote should be on the functions and over your domain. If you're in, if you've got omega, in the case of the polynomials, then you've got some choices, but let's not worry about that particular case right here. And the question is, how do you do that? Now, you could start out assuming that, in fact, you have a Hilbert space of holomorphic functions. But in order to work all this out, what one needs to introduce is the notion of localization. Let's see, is there a clock in here, or is it, I can't remember. Okay, localization of Hilbert modules. And one does this as follows. And let's suppose for simplicity now, I'm actually over the polynomials in M variables. And I've got a Hilbert module M. Now, when you're working over the polynomials, what I'm assuming, at least at this stage, is that multiplication by any one of the polynomials is a bounded operator. But there's not necessarily any uniform bound. Oh, I'm sorry, I left one out, in fact, which is relevant to that. This is what is often called the Drury-Arveson space, because I do want to come back to that. And I will use the notation H2 sub M, since we're in M variables. There's various descriptions of this. It's commuting weighted shifts where you've got the particular weights. It's symmetric Fock space. As far as I know, the first place it occurred was in a paper by Drury, was investigating the von Neumann inequality. The next, in fact, we could perhaps have a middle name in here, Lubin, because Lubin introduced this space as the example of commuting operators, each of which are subnormal, for which there is no common subnormal extension. But Bill was the first person to systematically study this in this particular context right here, at least, and other people, I should say. There's other antecedents for that, but I'm going to come back to that space. So M is a Hilbert module over this algebra right here. If I take a point let's work over the ball for this right here. I want to define this would be the maximal ideal in the polynomials. And what I want to do then is I want to look at the quotient of M modulo I omega naught times M. Now, this does not have to be closed, but I'm going to make the assumption it's closed as far as this one here is concerned. In other words, I'm going to assume that this times this. This is, of course, a submodule. This is a quotient module. And what I'm going to assume is that, in fact, the dimension of this, and this is dimension over the complex numbers, not any module dimension, is, in fact, n. And again, you could talk about the case where it's infinite, but let's assume that, it's, in fact, it's finite. So I'm going to make the assumption I've got a module for which this is the case right here. And what one can then do is one can show that there's a map from M into the holomorphic functions, well, if I'm on this ball right here. This is going to be one-to-one. Well, I need another assumption here. I need the assumption that if I take I omega naught and raise it to the k power times M and look at the intersection from k going from 0 to infinity, I want this just to be 0. And if I make that assumption, then in fact M can be realized as holomorphic functions. Actually, it's not taking values in Cm right here. So one can give an abstract definition of that. Now, this also has the property that if instead of looking at this space right here, if I looked at the intersection of the kernels of the multiplication operators M sub phi star, where phi is in your is a polynomial, and it vanishes at this point, then in fact this will be simply just I omega naught dot M perp. And we have two ways of looking at this. One of them is like this. This is, and then we have the dual picture, where in fact we can think of the map that sends omega naught to the current to this space right here. Let me just call it kernel omega naught right here. And this is in the Grassmannian of n-dimensional subspaces of the Hilbert space M. And this map here will be anti-holomorphic. Now, if one sets this up like this, one, let's see now, this is the one I have to worry about. If one sets this up like this, then you have the maps that sends omega naught to this M I omega naught dot M. This is a holomorphic map, and it defines a bundle E sub M over the ball. This is a Hermitian holomorphic rank N vector bundle, complex, of course, over the ball. If we were over the Pauli disk, it'd be over the Pauli disk, or it'd be over omega. And if I look at the one involving the kernels, I have this other map. This is anti-holomorphic, same thing. And as I said, this is a bundle built on quotients. This is a bundle built on subspaces. And you may recall, I'm not going to go into all of this, in the late 70s, Mike Callan and I, and followed up by Curto Salinas and others, studied these operators like this, bundles like this, and showed that the Hilbert modules are unitarily equivalent if and only if the bundles are equivalent as Hermitian holomorphic bundles. And either this picture or this picture, it doesn't matter. This was the picture that was used in the paper that Callan and I did and Curto Salinas did. But in many ways, it's more convenient to do this since everything is, in fact, holomorphic. So examples of operators or modules that satisfy these conditions right here, of course, all of the examples I put on the board up here except for the general contraction. So the goal then generally is to, given some class of Hilbert modules over an algebra, to find, as I said, find the existence or establish the existence of such resolutions by such modules. This class over here, satisfying these two conditions, are more or less what I've called quasi-free. Because what one's assuming is basically that locally they act, there is a section, the vectors in M determine sections of this vector bundle, and being a vector bundle, it is locally free. If I take a general Hilbert module and do something like this, what I'll end up with is something like a sheaf, and in many cases it'll actually be a sheaf. And in fact, one way of looking at what we're doing when we're doing resolutions are we are resolving a sheaf in terms of vector bundles. But of course, it's a little more than that because we've got the other structure. So let me, where are we? Excuse me a second. What I want to talk about then is that there are some examples and some theorems having to do with resolutions. I should say that the general question, you can ask a very general question here. Do resolutions always exist by quasi-free Hilbert modules always exist? Now, if you insist that the resolution, that the maps have these properties, that this be an isometry or that it be longer than this. See, this is a short resolution here with just of length 1 with 3 terms. It's basically a quotient. So this is a short exact sequence. And this, as I said, is an isometry. This is a co-isometry here. If you insist that your resolutions have those properties, then we're really talking about the question that people have looked at over the 60s, 70s, 80s, and that is the existence of things like unitary dilations. And of course, one knows that if you go to the two-variable situation, you've got Ondo's theorem that tells you that you can do something like this, not quite this. In the case of two variables, but you can't do it when you get to three variables or more and so forth. But the question in general is I don't think one wants to insist that your maps be required to be that nice. And so the question of existence of resolutions then takes a different form. So what I want to look at are, as I said, some examples of resolutions. So let me take this situation here. Let me specialize it. So I want to specialize it in two ways. Specialize the Nash-Voyage model. And I'm going to make this very simple, although you don't need to, it doesn't have to be as simple as I'm going to make it. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take theta to be a scalar inner function. And I'm sure that there's few, if anybody here, that does know what that means. It's an H infinity, a bounded holomorphic function, and it satisfies the properties that we've got over there on the boundary. This is one almost everywhere. And if I do that, then of course I can look at M theta, an operator that goes from the Hardy space to the Hardy space. And in fact, this, of course, is an isometry in this particular, and that, these, of course, are exactly the conditions for this to be an isometry. And so I can write down this, and this would be, I'll call this H theta. And this is the quotient map here. And what I've got is a special case, a very special case of the Nash-Voyage theory. A model. And if you study this right here, these are quasi-free, of course. And if you ask yourself about this, well, this is, of course, a familiar object in operator theory. It's a C0 operator, but it's the simplest possible case of a C0 operator. If you look at this short exact sequence here, I can actually localize it right here. And so I can actually get the localization of over either the disk algebra or the polynomial algebra. This will have the property that, in fact, this will be zero if and only if theta is zero. That point is equal to zero. And of course, and it will not be zero otherwise. This, of course, is just a very special case of a more general result of Nagy and Foyash on this. But this follows not from their theory, but simply by localizing this. You have a short exact sequence here. It stays, if you ignore this part, it continues to be exact. And then you simply have to calculate what this is right here. The characteristic operator function in this case is the localization of this map right here. And it's the decision as to whether points are in the spectrum of this or are in the support of the sheaf that corresponds to that is a question of whether or not this vanishes. This all works out very nicely right here. I'm not suggesting that one gets more information than one already knows here, but you can also do this example when theta is an inner function, from H2 sub e to H2 sub e star. In fact, looking at this picture right here, if I have this map, suppose I give this map, just simply call it X. Suppose I have the resolution from here to, of the Hilbert module H like this, where I simply give this map. Well, if you localize this guy right here, you can identify this as a bundle, a trivial bundle over the disk. You can identify, I'm sorry, except it's not C, it's E. You can do the same thing here over the disk. And if you make the same identification of this with this and this with this, in other words, not just point-wise, but globally over the whole disk right here, then when you localize this guy right here, in fact, what you get is, in fact, just back the characteristic operator function. So your characteristic operator function, from the point of view of resolutions, is nothing more than the localization of this map when you're talking about a short exact sequence. So you've got that right here. So now let me look at another example, which is a little different. Oh, and something which I'm also meant to mention over here in this particular case is that, in fact, something, as I told you, the Hermitian holomorphic bundle contains all the information. If it is a line bundle, which it is in this particular case right here for these guys right here, curvature is the whole story, and you can write down a relationship involving these two curvatures here, this function here, and this guy right over here. Now, this guy does not have curvature because it's a sheaf with support at just those zeros, but you can think of you can write down a sequence where what you end up with is a Dirac delta functions in your calculation corresponding to the zeros of this right here. Let's look at, however, one at an example where, in fact, everything is in the class that Callan and I introduced. Let's do the following. Suppose I've got now two functions, theta 1, theta 2, and they're both in H infinity of the disk. And again, I don't have to do it with two, but I want to look at the simplest possible case where things are show what's going on. And I want to make the assumption that now, because they're bounded, they have radial limits. And so I want to make the assumption that these radial limits have the property that they add up to one almost everywhere. So I can define an operator now, which I'll call M sub capital theta, going from one copy of H2 to two copies of H2, And again, the obvious way, m theta of f is theta 1 f plus direct sum theta 2 of f. And of course, this condition here is equivalent to the condition that m theta is an isometry. Now, if I make an additional assumption, I don't need any for this, but if suppose I make the assumption that theta 1 of z, absolute value squared, plus theta 2 of z, absolute value squared, is never zero for z in the disk. Then you can show under these circumstances, and again, it's the same kind of an argument involving this short exact sequence. Namely, let me, I guess, write it down over here. I write down this 0, and I've got one copy of h2. I've got m capital theta here, two copies of h2. And then again, I'm going to call this h sub theta. Then one can show under these circumstances that this condition right here implies that this module right here, or the operator, multiplication by z, whichever you want to call it, is in this class that Cowan and I introduced, b1 of d. And hence it has a curvature. And the curvature, of course, is the, this is the two-form valued curvature. And the curvature is a complete unitary invariant for h sub theta. And what one can show is, with a not terribly difficult calculation, is that that curvature is equal to the curvature of h2, the Hardy space, plus, I think it's right, is the Laplacian of the logarithm of absolute value theta 1. And as a consequence, then, you can decide when you write down models like this. In the Nash-Wash theory, theta has to be a complete unitary invariant. That's part of the theory as the characteristic operator function. But what one's here is, in this case, when this isn't here, you also have a different kind of complete unitary invariant, which is the curvature. And this is a formula that tells you what it is. And of course, as I said, I've done the simplest possible case. You don't need two. You could do n, although it gets a little more complicated. And you could also have more copies here. And you could even, if you wanted, if you were ambitious, do it with the case when this has coefficients in a Hilbert space and so forth and so on. But this is another kind of resolution where, in this particular case, we don't have a sheaf. We still have a vector bundle here, but we're resolving this vector bundle in terms of other vector bundles for which we know the behavior. And again, this is a case where this is still an isometry. This is still a co-isometry. But it turns out that in the one-variable situation, one of the nice things, which is to some extent equivalent to Bierling's theorem, but it's also the same thing as the existence of inner-outer factorization, if I took theta 1 and theta 2 to be bounded, and I wanted it to be bounded below, excuse me, so I wanted the sum to be, instead of 1 almost everywhere, if I merely assumed that this was bounded below on the circle so that it had closed range, I could do exactly the same thing with this condition right here. And so I could have a more what would appear to be a more general resolution, but of course, in the one variable situation, that in the one variable situation, that resolution could be reduced back to ones for which it is an isometry and a co-isometry. And that's one of the, I think, things that suggest that one should look at resolutions more generally in several variables. Because in several variables, of course, we don't have inner-outer factorizations. We can't match the modulus. The modulus is, in other words, there's no simple criteria for what the modulus of a holomorphic function in several variables on either the circle, well, on the ball or the, I'm sorry, the sphere or the distinguished boundary or something like that. Anyway, these are some examples of resolutions, some of the things you can do. And this is the beginning of a much bigger story, but it's not finished, and I'm not going to go further with that at this point. Now, let me talk about another kind of resolution. I mentioned the result of Ando. Now, I remind you that what one would get from Ando's result is this. So Ando basically says if I've got T1 and T2 and these are contractions, And they commute, of course. Then, of course, it tells me that there exists unitary dilation of T1 and T2. Now, without thinking too much and looking simply at examples, the question you can ask yourself is, what unitaries do you get in this particular situation? Now, in the Nash-Fourier situation on the disk, as long as you make the assumption that the powers of the adjoint go strongly to zero, then in fact what you end up with is that you end up with the Hardy space. And part of that's because in the case of the one variable or a single isometry, the structure of isometries is basically the shifts or the Hardy space directs on the unitary. And so you really have to simply just rule out that unitary piece. In this situation, of course, life is a little more complicated. If you ask about pairs of commuting isometries on the, in two variables, one knows that that can be a lot more complicated. But you can ask yourself the following question. In other words, when can I, well, I say dilate, but I'm actually mixing up dilation and coextension so that I have the Hardy space. In other words, when can I dilate so it's H2 of D squared? And what I mean by that is the following. In other words, I'm given these two contractions. I didn't put down the Hilbert space. These are on L of H. And so I can make the polynomials in two variables. I can make this into a Hilbert module over this in the obvious fashion. You simply substitute T1 and T2 for this right here. And I'm interested in then when I can find a map from H2 of D squared, E star to H, let's put a T on it. Zero. Now, I already have a problem. In other words, so the question is, can I do this, or when can I do this? Now, in the case of the one variable situation, once I actually get a map, let's see, once I get a map from H2 of D tensor E star onto my HT, one variable, zero, I'm done, in the sense that because if I look at the kernel of this map right here, the kernel will in fact be an H2 of D tensor E. And I'm done. When I come here, of course, once I get this, that's not the case, because in fact, what I'm saying is you get a submodule here, but that submodule in general is not, I mean, it's possible, but in general, it's not isomorphic to a copy like this. But let's focus just on this right here. Let's not ask for the whole thing. Let's just ask for the first term. Well, and in particular, you can write down some rather simple examples where you can't get that, which might be a little surprising. And what I'm talking about right now is a paper that we posted on the archive of myself, Misra, and Sakhar in the last, I guess, month or two. And one of the things there is the following. Suppose I look at the Hardy space on the bidisk, take the direct sum with the Hardy space on the disk. And I want to look at this as a module over the polynomials in two variables. Now, it's obvious what I'm going to do for this one. But for this one here, I'm going to take the diagonal action. In other words, I'm going to take a polynomial, and I'm simply going to substitute z, comma, z, and give myself this. And so this is now a very nice module over the polynomials in two variables. And in fact, it's subnormal. They're isometries. The action of Z1 and Z2 are isometries. But that's not the module I want. What I want is set let's call it C, to be the cyclic submodule generated by the vector 1 direct sum 1. So 1 is the usual function here on the bidisk. The other 1 here stands for the function on just the disk, the identity function there. And let C be this. And what one can show is there does not exist any map from H2 of D squared tensor E star to C to 0. Where this, but now this is where this map is in fact a co-isometry. So in fact, yes.
Could you say what the module action is?
Yeah, okay, sorry. In other words, well, it's the obvious one on this one. Well, okay, let me just... So I take a function in here. I'll call it f. It's f of z1, z2. Direct sum, a function in here, which is, I'll call it g of z. And by definition, this one here is simply just p of z1, z2, f of z1, z2, direct sum, and then this one here is just p of z, z, g of z. Okay? So it's the diagonal action on this one right here. And what one can show is that if you insist that this be a, that this map here be a co-isometry, there does not exist such a map. In other words, if you take... If you take, well, the Ando dilation or coextension is not unique, but what I'm saying, what we're saying here is no matter which one you choose, oh, actually in this case it is unique, but no matter which one you choose, you cannot get a coextension by this particular space right here. So it, what this example tells you is there is a problem, and it's a little bit subtle because these are not, you might think, if you're going to come up with an example like this, you'd have to come up with some exotic or esoteric examples. The answer is no. In fact, this is a very simple one. So the theorem that we prove is the following. And it's, again, this is not, there's more to be done, but let me just tell you this. I'm not going to tell you everything that's in the paper. In other words, suppose I let f of z w be the Zego kernel. This is, of course, the, in other words, it's for the Hardy space on the disk, one variable. And I'm sorry, no, I want it to be on the on the bidisk. So this is a the z here is the Z1, Z2, and the W is the W1, W2, here, right here. And suppose I take, suppose I'm given a kernel, a reproducing kernel Hilbert space, I'll call it H again, over the bidisk. With, this one's going to have kernel, I'll call it K, ZW. The question is, when does a dilation exist or a coextension? As I said, where your map is going to be a coisometry. Well, what one simply does is one takes S of ZW inverse, multiplies it times this. Now, because this guy here is scalar valued, this is a, this has the properties, in other words, the fact that these things don't commute, or, I mean, in general, they don't commute, but because this one's scalar valued here, this, in fact, does commute. In other words, scalar meaning it's a number times the identity in two variable. Well, it's the identity here. Then the question is, you want this to be positive as a kernel function. Except, yeah, that's right, inverse. So what one gets is a result for a restricted class The thing I had on the board, the C, which I guess is under here, is a reproducing kernel Hilbert space, so this result applies. Whereas if you calculate this, one way of proving that you can't do that is if you know the theorem, you can substitute and show, in fact, that what you get is not positive. Another way of doing it is you can just do it directly because, as I said, there are isometries. Therefore, the coextension is unique, and you can check that out. So this is another kind of result, but here one is talking about, as I said, is the you're asking whether or not you can find H2 D squared tensor E star onto your H, where this map here is a coisometry. Let me talk about something else. But let me take a look at my notes first. Yeah, there's a result of Nagy and Foyash which has to do with, again, it's not their, the result's not been stated in the language of resolutions, but one can profitably do that. And this is the following. The result of Nagy and Foyash is when is a operator, when is a contraction operator similar to the shift. And so in this situation here, what one is looking at is the following. So again, suppose I go back to 0 to H2. I'm back again in the one variable situation for now. So the question is, excuse me, when is H2, I'm sorry, when is H theta similar to an H2 space, where F is a Hilbert space, of course. And and the result that they obtained, in other words, there have been various people working on things like this. Is again, as I said, it's the result of Nagy and Foyash. Is that this happens? This result here is equivalent to theta has a left inverse. Now, what that's telling you here is, is that in fact you've got this map capital Psi that comes back, and of course you want this to be a module map. In other words, you want Psi theta like this to be the identity on this space right here. And there are various ways of proving that result. Again, in a paper which was posted recently by myself, Foyash, and Sarkar, which is on the archive now, we generalize this result to the Drury-Arvidsson space. So I want to tell you that, and then I want to tell you a little bit about how one goes about proving it. Let's see, maybe I come back over here. Well, the first thing to tell you is that one can generalize the Nagy-Foyash characteristic operator function and model to this situation here, and that, as far as I know, was first done. Well, again, we get into some ambiguity as far as who to give credit to. Because part of it is that a lot of these things were worked out in a non-commutative case by Popescu, and often one can, with a little bit of work, maybe sometimes a lot of work, show that that implies what happens in the commutative case. But let me stay with the history that I know in the commutative situation. And if anybody wants to correct it, I'm still a student and trying to learn who did what. In any case, there's a paper about, and I may, I'm not sure I'm going to get this name right. It's by Eschmeyer, who unfortunately canceled at the last minute, but I guess he has back problems, so he has my sympathies. In other words, and this is that if I take a I think what I'm going to say is correct, co-spherical contraction, a rho contraction, I think it's a rho contraction, so I've got T1 up to Tm on a Hilbert space H, and so I make H into a module over the polynomials in M variables. And again, the obvious fashion right here. Then there exists, and you can say it's unique, this so-called characteristic operator function, theta. And again, what it's going to go from, it'll basically go from the space E to the space. It's a multiplier space, and you can define it in various ways. I'm not going to get into that. But it is it is what's called an inner function. In this case, it means it's a partial isometry, not necessarily an isometry from this point of view. Again, so that the same setup. So in fact that you get, well, we don't have a zero in this case, but I use D. This is theta. H, I'll again call it T, to zero right here. Well, this is the quotient map again. And again, the question is the following. So this is a result of these three, and possibly these three, and possibly others. So the question is, in terms of theta, when is H sub T similar to, again, an H2M tensor F. And what we can, and what we prove is that that happens if and only if there exists that theta has a regular, I think what's called a regular inverse. Again, what we've got is a theta C going backwards from here to here. Not a left inverse. In fact, this map in general, this map will have a kernel here. But what you want is that theta C theta is equal to theta. And of course, since the case M equal 1 is the Hardy, ordinary Hardy space, one in fact gets another proof, a different proof of the result of Nash and Flash, and in fact, a slight generalization, well, wherever it is, slight generalization, because you don't need a left inverse. What you need is simply this regular inverse. Now, how does what are the ingredients of this? Well, the ingredients of this proof are several things that one of the kinds of when people started thinking about multivariable operator theory, probably in the, well, even the end of the 60s, the 70s, and much of, part of the 80s, maybe more of the 80s, what one, again, it was sort of like what happened to several complex variables, namely, what you ended up with was counterexamples. If you'd try to do something, it would turn out to be false. I mean, Beerling's theorem is an example. But the miraculous thing is that with perhaps slight modifications, it turns out that those one variable results, in fact, are true for the Drury-Arvidsson space, one of which is the Kami-Tott lifting theorem. And another is the Beerling-Lacks Helmholtz theorem on representing invariant subspaces. Now, in the commutative case, and again, we get into problems, questions about the credit. If I get this right here, stop me if I'm wrong. I think this is McCullough, at least by what I know, and Trent. And, of course, there's also Popescu, who did this earlier in the non-commutative case, but did not point out that, that there was a relevant theorem. And I must say that Ken, in other words, there's a paper that Ken just finished recently, and I did not have time to figure out exactly what the relationship lay, L-E? Right. This one right here, again, it's different people. It's Ball, Trent, and Vinnikoff. Since Tavon is here and Joe are here, they can correct me if I'm wrong. And again, Popescu, who had done this earlier, I think, again, earlier, at least in the non-commutative case, as far as that's concerned. So these two results become ingredients in proving that theorem up there, plus the model result right there. Now, rather than tell you more details of that, as I said, that's in there, let me tell you something a little more that comes out of this, came out of our study. And that's the following. One of the questions, when people did the model theory, when they were doing this model theory, which I guess I wrote up there at the top, one of the problems is that what you end up with over here is you don't end up with a zero here. Or at least you didn't know that you ended up with zero here. Well, one of the things that it's almost an observation is in this paper with Foyash and Sarkar is that there exists no isometry inner maps, inner functions from the space to the other space. I'm saying this wrong. Let me say it better. They do exist, they're just trivial. If V is a module isometry from this space to this space right here, then there exists V naught going from E to E naught, such that V is basically just V naught. In other words, you can split this. You basically have a map from E into E star. This is an isometry here. So that, in fact, it's basically just nothing more than you're matching this up with a reducing submodule of this. So it tells us. That you can't, in other words, in this case, you can't get short exact sequences like this right here. It also tells me that, in fact, there exists no finite resolution, well, what we've called an inner resolution of our Drury-Arveson modules. So that's the first part. Inner means that the maps are all inner maps. Now, when I say again no, it means that they have to be trivial because you can always do the following. What I should say is that there's a better way of putting it. Suppose I've got a finite resolution. So if you've got this here where it terminates and these arrows are all inner maps, then this implies that H is in fact not similar to, but actually. Partial isometries. Partial isometries. But they have to be exact, of course. Kernels and co-kernels have to match up. I guess I should have said that. By resolutions here, every time I've meant exact in the algebraic sense, not the closure of the range, but the range is equal to the kernel. So it tells you that if you're actually going to insist on resolutions by inner maps right here, partial isometry maps right here, The only thing you can resolve that way is one that's already like this. And in fact, you can say more about this. This thing has to just fall apart. There's one. Let me just say one last resolve. Let me see. What time is it? Well, let me finish. Let me just make a few comments and finish then, because I'm running out of time. Your first question you could ask yourself would be, okay, if you've got this result here, are there any finite resolutions by Drury-Arveson modules? The answer is yes. If you don't insist that they be partial isometries, in other words, again, I want the maps to have closed range and everything. If you want them to have, if you allow yourself to have maps, module maps that have closed range, then in fact you can certainly have not short exact sequences, but you can have finite resolutions. The simplest one is take the module, which is evaluation at zero. You can do this in two variables. Take this map right here, and then two copies of it. In other words, it's the same thing as the so-called Kozel complex. In other words, you can fill in the maps right here so that this is short exact. Notice it has length 2, however. I'm not sure whether there are any finite ones of length 1, but there probably are. I haven't thought too much about that. The other question is, you can also ask yourself the question, suppose I have, so this resolution, in other words, using results of Bill or of Arveson, given any co-contractive spherical or co-spherical contractive Hilbert module, there is always a canonical resolution by an inner resolution. It just keeps going, though, is what this says right here. You could ask yourself, suppose I know that H has a short, a finite resolution. Can you detect that? In other words, are there properties that you can detect? Well, in one case, the shortest possible, what we show is if you allow yourself to turn up the similarities, in fact, you can detect it. So there is, I guess our result in that direction basically says, if I don't insist that these be inner functions, inner maps, then in fact it's quite possible that resolutions by Drury-Arveson modules right here actually will be something that will give you results analogous to what happens in the case of Nagy and Foyesh for contractions. Well, as I said at the beginning, this is certainly not a complete theory. I've shown you various examples of resolutions that come up in several situations and what you can do with them, and some theorems that we have done. Actually, I've left out some things, but I've run out of time now. So thank you very much.